What are we to make of this? That something purportedly putrid and technically trafe is transformed into something so sublime, one of the essential sources of the most incredible experience in the temple. It is meant, perhaps, to remind us that the seemingly lowly aspects of human existence are not to be overridden or exercised, but channeled, directed, and transformed. Welcome to Parsha and Politics, Parashat Tetzaveh. The snail makes the man. I'm Meir Soloveitchik.
Parsha and Politics, How Torah Changed the World, is generously sponsored by Ivan Kaufman. Rabbi Soloveitchik's podcasts and essays on the Book of Exodus are generously sponsored by Karen and Alec Taylor. This week's episode is generously sponsored by Stephen Snell.
In 2017, a group of scientists at Southern Cross University issued an extraordinary announcement. They had identified one of the ancient ingredients of the ketoret, the incense offered every day in the sacred sphere of the temple. The spices would be poured upon the tiny golden altar that had been created specifically for this purpose. The smoke would rise like a pillar straight to the roof of the temple, and then spread all around, its ethereal scent suffusing the sanctuary. As our own parasha concludes the entire discussion of the creation of the tabernacle with this ritual, it appears that the incense offered every morning and afternoon was considered the spiritual high point of the daily service. We are told, "You shall make an altar to burn incense upon, of acacia wood shall you make it. And Aaron shall burn fragrant incense on it. Every morning when he dresses the lamps he shall burn it. And when Aaron sets up the lamps in the evening he shall burn it. A perpetual incense before the Lord throughout your generations." There has always been an obsession with the incense. The ingredients making it up were precisely calculated and perfectly balanced in order to produce the most sublime scent and ethereal experience. Yet over the centuries, the precise identity of the ingredients has become controversial, and the recent scientific research about one in particular is not only interesting in itself, it also allows us to understand how the incense in the temple embodies the essence of the Jewish vision, one not only captured in the ketoret, but also in one word for wool that appears throughout our reading. While we can easily identify some of the biblical and rabbinic words describing the ketoret components, one of the most mysterious is the second one appearing in a verse right after our reading, Exodus 30:34, which describes the incense. Moses is instructed, "Take for yourself nataf and shechelet." Nataf is a form of resin used to produce myrrh. What is shechelet? In ancient texts in Greece, shechelet is often rendered onaika, which means fingernail. That is exactly what it is also called in rabbinic Hebrew, in one of the most popularly recited texts of the Talmud, where it is described as tziporen, Hebrew for nail, matching the Greek translation. As the scientists wrote in a fascinating article in Nature magazine, the most logical explanation for this is that the ingredient is an extract from the shell of the murex snail known as operculum, because while many different possibilities have been put forward for the shechelet, nevertheless, quote, "none seem to fit the translation of onyka as well as the opercula of neogastropods, which is made of a strong protein similar to the keratin of fingernails," end quote. Indeed, as these scientists further note, other texts indicate that these shellfish were utilized in ancient incense production. At the same time, all extraction from these shells seem utterly unworthy of incense because they do not have a pleasant smell. But these scientists announced that they had figured out a procedure that would also have been known in ancient times, through which whatever was extracted from these shells was refined into a sweet-smelling substance. Kirsten Beckendorf, one of the scientists, wrote up their findings for a popular audience. Quote, "A predatory sea snail could be the source of a mystery ingredient in a holy incense recipe detailed in the Old Testament. Murex whelks were just one of many suspected sources, but there was no evidence to support the claim, until now. In a paper published today, my colleagues and I report how we captured and analyzed the fragrant chemicals in the smoke of whelk opercula, the trapdoor lid that protects the snail inside the shell. This provides evidence to help establish it as the most likely source of onyka, one of the four major ingredients that make up holy incense. Defined as fingernail or claw, onyka is a Greek translation from the original Hebrew word shecheleth, which derives from a tear distillation or exudation. Whelk opercula are a protein exudation similar to fingernails and have to be torn from the flesh before further processing. Ancient texts refer to unguisodoratus, sweet hoof, as the shell or scale of snails from the Red Sea that emit a pleasant smell when burnt. But shells," she continues, "and opercula do not smell nice when burnt. So after detaching the opercula from the flesh of the snail, it has to be processed. Ancient and modern practices include rubbing with alkaline solution or soaking in vinegar, followed by strong wine before burning the dried ground powder. In our experiments, we replicated these procedures using clean acetic acid and alcohol. This helped remove the fishy smell from the opercula before drying and grinding into a powder for chemical analysis. End quote. Fascinatingly, this scientific breakthrough about biblical incense parallels another advancement in biblical dye over the past decades, a dye used to create a famous form of wool, references to which are replete in our reading. The focus of Tetzaveh is the clothing of the Kohanim, the priest that ministered in the tabernacle, with particular emphasis on the high priest himself. Moses is told, "And you shall make sacred garments for Aaron your brother for honor and splendor." The high priest is a man reminded that he ministers for all Israel. He bears on his heart a breastplate bejeweled with 12 stones, emblazoned with the names of the tribes of his people, and two stones on his shoulders bear these names as well. A tzitz, a sort of crown on his head, bears the sacred name of God. But in truth, the dominant feature of this Kohen's clothing was not gold or jewels, but the color of one material. Our parasha again, "And you shall make a robe all of blue. It shall have in it an opening for the head with a woven binding around the opening, like the opening in a garment, that it may not be torn. And it shall be upon Aaron when he ministers." It was on this robe, known as a me'il, made entirely of techelet, wool dyed blue, that the other clothes of the high priest were placed, and it was threads of blue that held them together. Thus the breastplate was bound to a vest known as an ephod. Moses is also told, "And they shall bind the breastpiece by its rings to the rings of the ephod with a lace of blue." The same can be said for the crown, or tzitz. Again, Moses is instructed, "And you shall make a plate of pure gold, and you shall fasten it on the turban by a lace of blue. It shall be on the front of the turban." The overall effect was created by a wool of brilliant blue, known as techelet. And as Rabbi Yaakov Maidan has noted, citing the Talmud, "This aesthetic element is meant to remind one of heaven itself and of the effect of sapphire stone that was seen in the elders' vision of God at Sinai." Rabbi Maidan quotes the Talmud, "Why is techelet set apart from all other varieties of dye? Because blue resembles the sea, and the sea resembles the heaven, and the heaven resembles the throne of glory, as it is written, 'And they saw the God of Israel, and there was beneath his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and as it were, the very heaven for clearness.'" End quote. There is no high priesthood without the techelet, the wool which is dyed to produce a heavenly effect. But how is this effect produced? Over a century ago, Rabbi Yitzchak Herzog, then the future first chief rabbi of Israel, wrote his doctorate on the chilazon, the Talmudic name for the sea creature from which the blue dye was reportedly procured. As with the incense ingredients, all evidence pointed to a lowly snail known as the Murex trunculus. But, as Rabbi Herzog noted, the snail substance could create purple dye known as argaman, but not blue. Rabbi Herzog died with the mystery unresolved, and it was only decades later that the answer was found. The secretion of the snail needed to be exposed to the sun, and then blue dye could be made. Thus, Baruch Sturman tells us that, quote, "The most substantial problem that Herzog had with trunculus was that the dye obtained from that snail produced a blue-violet color, and not the sky blue you traditionally associated with techelet. This issue was really the core of the difficulty in identifying the chilazon with the trunculus." And Sturman continues by adding, "In the early 1980s, while researching ancient dyeing techniques, Otto Elsner of the Shenkar College of Fibers in Israel serendipitously discovered the secret of producing a pure blue color from the trunculus snail, thus solving Herzog's fourth and most compelling difficulty. Elsner noticed that wool dyed on cloudy days tended towards purple, while on sunny days the color was pure blue. Together with Ehud Spanier of Haifa University, he investigated the photochemical properties of the trunculus dye and found that when the dye is in a reduced state, a prerequisite for dyeing wool, exposure to ultraviolet light will transform the blue-purple colorant to unadulterated blue." End quote. We must ponder the poetry inherent in the science. The sublime aesthetic effect of the high priest only occurs when the sunlight shines on earth, transforming a smelly substance from one of the lowliest creatures in existence into a source of brilliant blue, so that suddenly the effect of the very heavens is bestowed in our material realm. Similarly, in her article on the incense, Kirsten Beckendorf notes that the snail, which is not only a pungent but also a non-kosher creature, is the source of both heavenly wool and a sacred smell within the temple. She writes, quote, "The main argument against the identification of sea snail opercula as the Onyka of antiquity is that creatures such as these were described as unclean animals in the Bible." And she adds, "But one particular group of sea snails, the Muricidae or Murex, were highly regarded as a source of Tyrian purple, shellfish purple, and techelet, biblical blue. In biblical times, these shellfish were the only known source of an insoluble purple dye. The incorporation of purple and blue dye yarn is prescribed for use in the tabernacle and garments worn by high priests." End quote. In other words, one of the essential elements of the incense, one without which the incense is invalidated, is extruded by a non-kosher creature, something that in its original form smells fishy and foul, and yet, when refined, when properly prepared and assimilated into the larger arrangement of ingredients, this substance suddenly produces the most sublime scent for the most mystical rite in the entire temple. Just as the murex snail is used to produce the tehillat on the clothes of the Kohanim, evoking the azure image of the sky, so too can the snail provide an incense ingredient that bestows the scent of heaven itself. What are we to make of this, that something purportedly putrid and technically treif is transformed into something so sublime, one of the essential sources of the most incredible experience in the temple? What is the symbolism of this sacred substance that stems from a pungent shellfish? The cloud of the ethereal incense, as we mentioned last week, is intended to embody the human spirit. And if a lowly bit of earthly existence is transformed into something sublime, it is meant, perhaps, to remind us that the seemingly lowly aspects of human existence are not to be overridden or exercised, but channeled, directed, and transformed. The goal of Judaism is not to reject this world, but to sanctify it. Not to deny the pleasures of this world, but to channel and transform them. Not to ignore our urges as sinful and animalistic, but rather to direct them toward the service of God. One example of this, as Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has written, can be found in Judaism's positive approach to the human desire for wealth creation. He wrote, quote, "Philosophical advocates of the market, Bernard Mandeville, David Hume, and Adam Smith, were struck by a phenomenon that many consider to be scandalous and amoral. This was their discovery that the market produced benefits to all through a series of actions and transactions that were essentially self-interested in their motivation. As Adam Smith bluntly put it, it is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. Within the system of free trade, as Smith put it most famously, the individual intends only his own gain, and he is, in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention." This fact, Rabbi Sacks continued, that markets and their associated institutions tend to work on the basis not of altruism, but of somewhat earthier motives, has always led to a high-minded disdain for everything suggested by the word commercial. Not so, Rabbi Sacks continued, within Judaism. Long before Mandeville and Smith, Judaism had accepted the proposition that the greatest advances are often brought about through quite unspiritual drives. End quote. And Rabbi Sacks further deduces this from a Talmudic statement, which tells us, were it not for the evil inclination, no one would build a house, marry a wife, have children, or engage in business. So the Talmud tells us, so Rabbi Sacks writes, and this does not mean, of course, that selfishness is celebrated, but rather that every urge within us is created by God and has a positive and productive outlet. The Torah, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik reflected in a philosophical essay, quote, does not reject any human feelings as unworthy and destructive, end quote. No natural emotion or urge is inherently sinful. Each has its proper application. Thus the incense, which is offered on the altar and rises directly to God, in which seemingly unpleasant substances are sublimely sanctified, is intended to represent human capacity in all its complexity. A similar message can be derived from the Tehillat of the high priest. In his most famous philosophical metaphor, Plato described a man emerging from a lifetime in a cave to behold the sun, explaining how the philosopher seeks to escape our own existence, full of shadow and falsehood, for the ethereal world of brilliant ideas. We can contrast this allegory to the creation of the priestly blue, in which the sun radiates down on our existence, transforming something seemingly unworthy into the very symbol of sanctity, so that a bit of the blueness of heaven is created here on earth. The world is not to be escaped, but to be sanctified instead. The science behind the Tehillat reminds one of a short story by the Yiddish writer Eyal Peretz, who tells of a Hasidic leader, or Rebbe, who during the penitential season did not show up for prayers. The Rebbe's followers speculated that their leader had ascended to heaven to plead for mercy on behalf of his flock. There lived in that town, writes Peretz, a lone Litvak, a Jew of Lithuanian origin, known to be of a less mystical bent than his Hasidic brethren, and was devoted first and foremost to the minutiae of Jewish law. Peretz writes, "You know how those Lithuanian Jews are. They care little about devotional books, but they cram themselves full of the Talmud and similar codes. The Litvak scoffed at the community's suggestion that the Rebbe had ascended to heaven, and so he stalked the rabbi, following him to the outskirts of town, where they came upon a shack in which there lived a poor woman. The spying Litvak watched as the rabbi fed the woman and took care of her. From that point on," writes Peretz, "the once cynical Litvak became a follower of the Rebbe, and whenever the Hasidic shtetl dwellers would suggest that the Rebbe could be found in heaven, the Litvak would invariably respond, if not higher." Note well Peretz's literary maneuvers. He does not make the Litvak into a standard follower of the rabbi, who believes his leader escapes the world, transcends the world, that the rabbi prefers heaven to earth. Rather, the Litvak has realized that through the Rebbe's sacred actions, the hovel of a hut has become holy here on earth. He realizes that no act exists in a vacuum, but rather has the power to sanctify, to endow physical earth with the glory of God. Plato, in C.S. Lewis's phrase, saw this existence as a shadowlands. Judaism, to borrow another phrase from Lewis, seeks to endow this earth with patches of godlight in the woods of our experience. Thus, the creation of priestly garments gives us a symbol of Judaism itself. It is often said that clothing makes the man. Here, the snail, from the depths of the sea and the earth, helps make the holiest man on earth. Only then does the high priest of the temple represent us before God, so that the science and symbolism of his glorious garment remind us not to reject our humanity or earthly existence, but to create a sanctity which, in a certain sense, can be higher than heaven itself. This is Meir Soloveitchik, wishing you a Shabbat Shalom, looking forward to learning together next week, signing off.